Hi, and welcome to the pod How to Heritage, where we talk about and have conversation around issues pertaining to heritage transformations. This pod is part of the Heritage Transformation Network at Uppsala University, funded by CIRCUS, Center for Integrated Research on Culture and Society. However, the content and views expressed in the pod belong to the content creator and not the network nor its members, although some may share these views. My name is Emma Hogström-Molin and I am a researcher and teacher at the Department for History of Science and Ideas at Uppsala University. My research focuses on questions related to the concept of provenance and dislocated heritage in the 19th century. Today, I will discuss the concept of ignorance in archive history, together with the idea that ignorance and knowledge simultaneously work together in shaping epistemic hierarchies, and how this is connected to the issue of heritage transformation in the context of archives, in this case, the Swedish National Archives. I will start with giving a brief summary of how ignorance has been debated within the history of knowledge field. And then I will move on to a case of translocated files, the Mittal files that came to the Swedish Empire in the 17th century. So far, my research has dealt quite a lot with the epistemic orders of archives and libraries and the classification of knowledge. Thinking with ignorance, however, and how it helps constituting epistemic hierarchies is something new to me, which make this pod talk rather explorative and open. And I hope that it will encourage its listeners to think about these issues in relation to maybe your own work as a researcher, as an archivist, or at an heritage institution. Let me start with addressing what is the history of knowledge. This is something that is currently under debate among historians. My discipline, history of science and ideas, is quite broadly defined and a Swedish phenomenon. And in the Anglophone world, history of science mainly equals the natural sciences and has therefore been supplemented by intellectual history as well as the history of humanities. Against this backdrop, the history of knowledge has been introduced for several reasons. One important analytical point has been to transcend disciplinary boundaries that are anachronistic anyway. What is knowledge then? As pointed out by Peter Burke, answering this question is as complicated as solving the problem of what truth is. Burke has distinguished between information or raw material from knowledge, which he sees as information that has been processed or cooked. According to this, archival documents that contains information, when they have been classified and organized in a space, they may also be understood as knowledge. Ignorance, then, has been brought into the history of knowledge by Peter Burke and Lucas Verbeugt in a recent theme section in the Journal of the History of Knowledge. In their introduction, they argue that ignorance and knowledge are mutually constituting, and instead of thinking of them as opponents, they can be seen as creating epistemic hierarchies and thus reflecting different ways of knowing and not knowing in a given time and place. By studying ignorance and incorporating it with the history of knowledge, the latter can become something else than a mere expansion of the history of science. Moreover, since knowledge is a vague and baggy concept, if it were to be replaced with the idea of epistemic hierarchies, much can be won. In this manner, ways of knowing and not knowing in the past may be fleshed out. What Burke and Verbeugt draw upon here is a turn to ignorance in anthropology, sociology, and philosophy as a way to challenge some of these disciplines' traditions. One point is that ignorance cannot be overlooked nor reduced to something that has to be overcome. And moreover, we should remember that scientific knowledge always leads to new notions of what is unknown. In other words, the more we know, the more aware we become of what we don't know. How then can we study ignorance as a historical phenomenon? Burke and Verbeugt suggests that if we agree that the history of ignorance is something more than a simple absence of knowledge, we must recognize different kinds of ignorance, for instance, secrecy, errors, lies, fiction, and so on. And most importantly, if knowledge and ignorance are mutually constituting, we cannot say that ignorance is absent when knowledge is present. Rather, every order or regime of knowledge is always also a regime of ignorance. What I would like to propose is that when it comes to heritage histories, it might be fruitful to think of ignorance as something that has its own charm or possibility, especially in relation to spoils of war or looted heritage. Accordingly, when it comes to epistemic hierarchies attached to heritage loss, I would even like to suggest that in some cases, ignorance might be just as desirable as knowledge. So it's high time for me to turn to my case. Let me start with explaining what the mitophiles were and are. The mitophiles are parchments and papers abducted during war by the Swedish King Gustavus Adolphus from Mittau Castle in the Duchy of Courland, located in the historical province Livonia, and this happened in 1621. Livonia was under Swedish control 1621 to 1610 when Russia took over. And during most of the Swedish rule of Livonia, Mittau remained under the Duchy of Courland, but the Duchy of Courland was invaded by the Swedish troops at two times. And today, of course, this location belongs to Latvia. So the files in question, known in Swedish 17th century sources as the Mittau files, were incorporated in the Swedish National Archives in Stockholm in 1622. The archives were then located in the castle Tre Kronor. And following the Mittalfiles' trajectories over centuries revealed that some of them are preserved in the National Archives to date. Others were restituted, went up in flames in a fire that took place in 1697, or simply disappeared during centuries of movements and reorganization of the collections. A history of the Mittalfiles in Sweden is indeed a history of presence, knowledge and power, but also of absence, ignorance and loss. First and foremost, it is an account of change in the relationship between knowing and not knowing these files. As an object of study, the multiple Mittalfiles are elusive in the sense that the sources only give limited information about the object's size and contents, and it never reappears twice in exactly the same state. Consequently, we can never fully know these files, and therefore ignorance becomes such an evident part of the history. And I will try to go through this history to date as simple as I can without giving too much nitty-gritty details that might distract us from the theme of the pod today, that is ignorance, of course. But you will notice that this is easier said than done. So I will start with talking a little bit about the files' history before they came to Sweden, because the records taken from Mittau Castle by the Swedish king, they had mainly been produced from the 13th century and onwards by the Catholic military order, the Livonian Brothers of the Sword, which from 1237 was an anonymous branch of the Teutonic Knights. When the Livonian order was abolished in 1561, its last master became Duke of Courland, and records produced more recently by the Duke's administration were thus also taken by the Swedish king and his men. It would be misleading to describe what was taken in Mittau as a comprehensive archive, as the order's records had been moved around during the Russian-Livonian War, and that was between 1558 and 1583, possibly also with some losses. And finally, the files ended up in Mittau, in the castle there, at the end of the 16th century. It is also impossible to know if all records present in Mittau in 1621 were considered sufficiently valuable for transport to Sweden. Nevertheless, the documents that were seized in Mittau were eventually packed in three chests and two barrels and shipped to the Swedish kingdom. In the Swedish 17th century sources, these files are generally referred to as the documents from Mittau or Livonian and or Kullandian files, descriptions that clearly relate to the place of origin, but without any consideration of the heterogeneity of their contents. And even if what is preserved at the National Archives today is just a fragment of all the documents once produced by the Masters of the Livonian Order, I would like to underline that it is still the largest preserved collections of sources of the Order's history known to date. When the files were delivered to the National Archives in Trekronor Castle in 1622, the contents were recorded by an archive secretary. His name was Per Månsson Utter, and he was the first to hold this office in Sweden. The inventory that Utter made is fairly thorough, but by no means complete. And at the time that the Mittau files arrived, the archive secretary was busy arranging the archive from the ground, as the first systematic organization of the Swedish National Archives was launched in the 17th century. And sources are preserved in which the work of these files are described in great detail. That Swedish officials regarded the Mittau documents to be a very important historical and political resource is obvious. The old parchments were perceived as the most valuable material. They included correspondence between the order in Livonia and the Teutonic order in Prussia and the Pope, together with rights to lands, castles and cities, recesses between the estates and various kinds of border letters, documents from the order's chancery, noble family archives, and even monastic archives. Letters sent to princely correspondence in Livonia by Swedish kings were also mentioned. The remaining content of the barrels and chests consisted of paper files, mainly time-consuming missives and concepts to which the archive secretary paid less comprehensive attention. An interesting detail is that even damaged Mittau parchments, for which instance had been torn, were still kept and preserved in the Swedish National Archives over a longer period of time. And this really says something about how highly valued the parchments were. After the inventory was completed, the Mittau files became an integral part of the National Archives, as they were placed in one of the archives' two cabinets at hand, reserved for the most valuable documents. Yet the documents were mainly kept together and they were not mixed with other Swedish files. The prominent placement of the Mittau files, however, did not last long. The archive secretary, who succeeded Utter, immediately removed the Mittau documents from the cabinet. Now these files were broken apart, partly assimilated and partly alienated inside and outside of the archive rooms. One important detail is that the epistemic order of the National Archives endorsed the genealogy of the Vasa kings, as the deeds were organized according to each Vasa ruler. The Vasa family was a fairly new royal dynasty to the Swedish throne, established by Gustav Vasa, who seized the Swedish throne through rebellion in 1523. Remarkably, the organization of the National Archives then became one way of legitimizing the Vasa rule. The Mittau files kept challenging the archives order, not only by demanding space and attention, but also because their origin and content did not always fit into the genealogical narrative that the archive officials were trying to create. This meant that just after a few years, the records were dispersed throughout the castle. Some deeds that could be related to the Vasa kings directly disappeared among other documents in each king's collection. Their geographical origin and identity thus transformed into Swedish. Nevertheless, certain old and therefore particularly valuable parchments taken in Mittau were still kept together, stored in a portable casket, making them easy to access and move around in archive rooms. Other Mittau documents, possibly the paper files, were more difficult to classify or were perceived as less important, and they were stored in chests and boxes in another part of the castle, away from the archive rooms. Here, metal files were held together with unorganized documents. For instance, spoils abducted from German mines in 1631, monastery archives confiscated during the Swedish Reformation, and concepts from the Swedish king's registries, all waiting to be sorted out. The point I wish to make here is that the movements and the re-evaluation of the files that caused the transformations destabilize the knowledge that existed about the documents so far in this particular context. Consequently, when new knowledge about the files was produced, ignorance was created as well, as prior knowledge was lost. Okay, so let's move forward and take a look at how restitution requests, in this instance from the Curlandian dukes, highlight the mutually constituting relationship between knowledge and ignorance. Already in 1622, when the Mittal files came to the National Archives in Sweden, the first petition for the restitution arrived. It seems that only about 15 of the most recent documents were returned as originals and or as copies, as it was decided in the end that just these particular files concerned the Curlandian dukes. About 50 years later, in 1686, a new restitution request arrived, which was personally handled by the Swedish king at the time, Charles XI. He ordered that all documents abducted from Mittau in 1621 should be listed. This inventory described 1,095 deeds, of which no more than 193 were returned in the end, in original and or as copies. The exact restituted number is difficult to know, as the sources give different amounts. Remarkably, however, when this inventory was created, documents of very different origins, such as Swedish and Prussian, the latter confiscated during Gustavus Adolphus' campaign in Prussia in 1626, were added to the Mittal files, once again changing the composition of this object. Consequently, while the knowledge of what had once been taken in Mittau had partly disappeared among Swedish archivists, recurring restitution requests show that the Curlandian dukes did not forget the loss. To the Curlandian dukes, the Mittau files were conspicuous by the absence, although the dukes' knowledge of the document's contents or the actual need for them is difficult to be certain of. The turbulent existence of the Mittau files stretches over centuries, as well as the epistemic hierarchies of knowledge and ignorance that they have caused. On the 7th of May, a fire broke out in Tre Kronor Castle. Men were promptly sent to save the National Archives, but the fire spread fast and some of the Mittau files were doubtlessly lost in this event. In all, about a third of the entire archive went up in flames. And afterwards, the National Archives were temporarily placed in an old stable. And in the post-fire turmoil, additional documents seem to have been lost, perhaps even to thieves. For instance, in 1701, the book auctioneer Richard von der Hart was questioned regarding his unauthorized visits to the archive and was accused of illegally copying of Livonian files, clearly what once had been known as the Mittau files. At this point in history, Sweden was involved in the Great Nordic War, which, among other things, led to the loss of Livonia. The political situation was thus extremely tense, and von der Hart might have been a spy, and this episode also demonstrates that the Mittau files were still political dynamite 8 years after their abduction. But it also suggests that an intruder could use the opportunity created by the fire and the disorder that followed to access sensitive knowledge, and that the archival officials were somewhat ignorant and always one step behind. In the 19th century, the Mittau files remaining in Sweden caught the attention of historians and source collectors as historiographical provenance research became a trend. Another inventory of Livonian files in Swedish archives and libraries was published in 1860 by the Baltic German historian Carl Schirren, whose research activities in Sweden are shrouded in mystery. Some of the documents that Schirren highlighted in his publication Verzeichnis Livländer Gesichtsquellen in Schwedischen Archiven und Bibliotheken have never been seen since he worked with them, as they disappeared under mysterious circumstances. Were they made up by him or even stolen? Or was the Swedish archivist's ignorance of the collections so conspicuous that they rather questioned Schirren's research and his expertise than their own knowledge about the files? Somehow, ironically, Schirren's 19th century inventory of the medieval parchments taken from Mittau is still valid in the Swedish National Archives today. So this means that if I, as a researcher, wish to see a parchment, the call number is Schirren number 1, or Schirren number 2, Schirren number 3, and so on. Consequently, in the 1860s, one foreign scholar had the possibility to dictate the epistemic order of a sub-archive that he researched, which the Swedish officials were ignorant of. Thus, an epistemic hierarchy appears in which a state institution became dependent on the efforts and agenda of an outsider. Of the 3 chests and 2 barrels filled with documents of various kinds that were taken from Mittau Castle in 1621, there are 26 numbers in the Department for Foreign Parchment Letters and 50 boxes among the paper files left in the Swedish National Archives today. Even if this is just a fragment of all the documents once produced by the Livonian Order, as I mentioned initially, it is still the largest preserved collection of sources of their history known to date. I have now reached my conclusions. In this pod talk, I have argued that as the knowing of the Mittau files has transformed over the centuries, these transformations have created an unequal amount of ignorance, as these two concepts are inseparable. So in this way, I am agreeing with Burke and Verbergt. To sum up, I would like to first point to something that most heritage historians are aware of, but the common historian often is ignorant of, and that is the different layers of meanings that the course of time has added to our objects of study, and how we can make these layers visible. This is not least true for archival sources. If historians insist on maintaining the text-object separation, we will remain ignorant of the epistemic structures and hierarchies that inevitably influence the history that we produce from archival sources. So consequently, we should reflect over why a 13th century parchment is classified as Schirren number 1 or Schirren number 2 or Schirren number 3. At the beginning, I argued that in some heritage histories, ignorance might be just as desirable as knowledge. Here I am thinking about the kind of provenance research that Carl Schirren's work in Stockholm represented that I have been studying for some time, and I have also looked into other cases. For instance, in 1851, the Moravian and Benedictine scholar Bida Dudik was sent to Sweden to investigate rumours that claimed that 7,000 to 8,000 volumes of printed books and manuscripts, along with other kinds of valuable objects once plundered in Moravia and Bohemia during the 17th century, were still to be found in Sweden. Both Schirren and Dudik represented marginalized historical regions, and they were striving to increase knowledge of regional history and access to historical sources that supported it, which brought them both to Sweden. In the end, Dudik could only locate, classify, and describe a total of 39 numbers of sources, far from the 7,000 to 8,000 volumes that he was sent to find. Producing this knowledge resulted in shattering the fantasies of uncovering rich historical treasures, which illustrates that ignorance may actually be a bliss. Returning to Schirren then, he was a Baltic German that opposed the Russification politics of the Russians of virginity, which eventually forced him into exile in Prussia. A major part of his scholarship dealt with the Livonian Knights, as their rule of Livonia represented Baltic independence to him. Could these circumstances, together with Schirren's high hopes for what he would like to find in the Swedish archives, have led him to fabricate sources? This is just one of the questions that I can't answer at the moment, but I hope that I will be able to towards the end of my project in a few years. You have been listening to the pod How to Heritage, and my name is Emma Hagström Molin. Today I have discussed the concept of ignorance related to heritage transformation in the context of archives. Thank you so much for listening.